People.
Don't you know?
Places.
Don't you know?
Events.
Don't you know?
From the campus of Winona State University, KQAL FM is proud to present...
Don't you know?
The Big Muddy River Rendezvous was held the week of October 10th at Prairie Island Campground in Winona, Minnesota. The purpose of the rendezvous is to educate people about the pre-1840s fur trading era. School children attend, and people from the community come out to experience the way people lived, worked, dressed, survived, played, and helped shape our nation. On today's edition of Don't You Know, we visit with Gene and Andrea, who have set up camp to educate attendees on dyeing fabric and fabric woodblock printing. The two will share with us why they enjoy the rendezvous, how it's a family affair, and what life is like while taking part in the festivities. You're listening to Don't You Know.
And this is Faribault Millinery. Basically, we print calico the old way with woodblock printing. And a long time ago, the lady would want a gown made and have her fabric custom done, which was all woodblock stamped by apprentices. The average colonial gown with the full panniers was about 14 yards of fabric and could take up to 8 months to make from start to finish. We have the kids come over and they print. And they actually apprentice for us because we're making some real fabric too.
My name's Andrea Ellis. I'm the second part of Faribault Millinery. I'm the dyer in the group. I get to hang out in the back by the open flames and the boiling pots of who knows what. Once the kids are done working with Jeannie at the front table doing the stamping, we bring them over and actually walk them through the dyeing processes. What would have been used out at a camp like this, like the grass would have been green, the leaves would have been brown. We did a coffee dye today with a large group of children that makes a real light brown color. And we explained to the kids that they would have been apprenticed with somebody like me between 6 and 10 years old. Most of the reason for that is by the time the kids hit high school age, 13 to 15 years, they'd have shops of their own. And by the time they were in their 20s to 30s, they were looking at health problems or knowing the local grave digger because they weren't around anymore due to the chemicals that would come out of the vats. But we spend a lot of time going through with the kids, different types of dyes, different reactions with the dyes. Even got into a discussion with one group about how much urine and feces are used in certain colors and what their blue jeans are made out of. It's a lot of fun and a lot of learning on our end, too, from the kids.
Up next, we get to listen in as Andrea explains to a group of school children how fabric dyeing was handled in the pre-1840s fur trading era and her job as an apprentice for a millinery.
Well, I would be what they call a backwoods dyer. Okay. Anybody know what a union is?
No, I know what a union is.
You know what a union is? Okay.
Our country's a union.
Hey, pretty good. Nice. What unions normally are is there'd be one person in charge and a bunch of other people that are helping, and there's certain standards you'd have to follow. Guilds were the same way. In about the 1700s, there were dyers' guilds. You'd work under the royalty in the country you lived in. Like if I was from France, I'd work under the King of France under supervision from a master and would only be allowed to dye certain colors. Okay. Well, I came over to the colonies because I didn't want to follow those rules. So I get to do what I want out here with the fur traders and trappers. So what we'd do is we'd work with the seamstresses and we'd work with the stampers to be able to help make the fabric and keep the ladies and the gentlemen in the camps clothed. Now, if you went to order a dress, say, for Christmas, how long do you think it would take to get one made? Best guess.
7 days.
7 days? Anybody else?
3 or 4 weeks.
3 or 4 weeks? You're getting closer.
A month.
Or 2 months. Closer. Closer.
A year.
You know what? She's got it. You'd start out coming into a shop like our millinery and you'd order the type of print and the style of fabric you'd want. They'd spend the time stamping and getting it all ready. They'd send it to a dyer like myself who'd get all the background colors put on. Then you'd send it to a seamstress who would have it all cut out and they'd hand sew it together because sewing machines weren't around until about the 1800s. Okay, you guys have seen like the beigey brown on the old parchment paper, or you see like the tent color where it's just kind of that little bit of brown on it. That's what a coffee dye does. We use this because it's a very quick dye, because I can't keep you guys here for a week to get the color to be really dark. What we were learning to do before they got to the neat chemical stuff, we were the ones that were starting to figure out how it stuck. So like with this dye, we use an alum base. When we first started out, it's just water and alum, and then we add coffee beans to it. Well, what that does is it opens up the little fibers in the cotton fabrics, so the color actually stays instead of washing out when it hits the regular water. We'll stir it off and on, because otherwise it burns to the bottom and then it makes your clothes really gross.
Andrea goes on to explain how different colors are achieved in the dyeing process.
There's a lot of different things that make purple. One that we're going to try to bring out next year if you guys get to come walk around. Anybody know what nightshade is? It's a really nasty weed a lot of farmers don't like. And there's a little black berry on it that can make pets sick if they eat it. Well, it's the nightshade berries that we collect, and you crush them up and you put them in a pot like this, and then my darling apprentices would all either have to go home to their farms, because most people at that time had some type of livestock, or you'd have to go to a local farm and you guys would be bringing me back buckets of sheep poo. Sheep feces, believe it or not, has an acid level to it that helps turn the berries lavender. So it makes a really pretty purple color when it's cooked in the pot. How would you do blue? Blueberries? That actually goes a very light blue. How would you get a dark blue, like your jeans? Believe it or not, a lot of blues would have been very hard for somebody like me to make, because it would have been indigo or woad, which would have been imported from Europe and Indonesia at the time. You guys can pass this around. It is a glass bottle, so let's not throw it at each other, okay? That's indigo powder. It's actually a mold or a fungus that's on the backside of a particular plant that they get. Now, you guys want a real, real scary one? They're all real tough, right? Nobody's gonna get sick? That's how they get your blue jeans colored, even today.
Spiders.
It's actually indigo powder and urea. Urine.
Whoa!
What's urea?
Like urine. Pee.
Pee.
Believe it or not, the acid level in urine, they have still not found a way to reproduce that any other way, so we still use that. All right, do you know where they got it from? It's not as gross as you think. You know how we have indoor bathrooms now? Back in my time, you didn't have that luxury. So if you went into a pub or you went in to have your dinner at one of the local palaces, you'd pay a stipend. You'd pay a bartender a little bit of money to be able to go back and use either their pickle barrel or their whiskey barrel or their wine cask. They look like a big basin. And you'd basically do your business in the barrel. They'd seal it up once it was full. They'd wait for a while, and then they'd sell it to a dyer like myself. So yes, we're the crazy people wandering around town buying barrels of pee. But it was the one way they could actually get the colors to stick and that they'd be color fast. Otherwise, like your pretty orange shirt, if you didn't have it so the colors were sticking, you'd be out in the sun and you'd end up with a white shirt by the end of the day because the color would just bleach out. That was how they got it to stick.
And so what do they use now?
Believe it or not, your blue jeans, it's still done the same way it used to be.
I don't like jeans.
You're safe.
I'm either wearing shorts or my Rebel Spins.
It's actually what they call distilled urea. It's a little different than just, you know, going to the restroom in a bucket. This stuff's all chemically treated. It's all clean.
Up next, Andrea goes on to explain the further duties of an apprentice studying underneath a millinery business.
Now, you guys would have been responsible for hauling water. You would have been responsible for keeping the fires going.
Whoa!
And part of the reason why they started you guys out that young is by the time you were my age, hitting your 30s, you were either very, very lucky to still be around. You see how all the smoke's coming off the cauldron? And it's kind of floating up. Now, this is just coffee. This won't make you sick. It might make you hyper, but it won't make you sick. There are some dyes that being over the vat all day, it caused lung problems. And in the 1700s, they weren't 100% positive what it was. So you'd start out at a very young age. By the time you were in your teens, you'd actually be looking at working in shops of your own, because by the time you were my age, you weren't around anymore. You'd end up very, very sick from some of the chemicals. There's different plants like bloodroot that they'd use to turn the fabrics different colors, and it actually causes your blood to thin and it makes you very, very sick, and we didn't know at my time what caused it.
Up next, we continue our interview with Jean and Andrea about how they became involved with the rendezvous, why they continue to attend, and the culture and lifestyle that surround it. You're listening to Don't You Know.
That's her.
Rendezvous were still new. I was actually taken along with a family. I was dating someone at the time whose family did this, and it was brothers and sisters and sister-in-laws and cousins in a large group. So for 4 years, I sat in camp going, I don't get to make fires. I don't get to do any of the fun stuff like the dishes. So then I got going, and he's a friend, and so very close with the families yet, but got my own tent and started coming out. In the meantime, my daughter said she likes the Renaissance fairs, and we made a deal that she would go to Rendezvous if I would go to Renaissance, And in the meantime, I wanted a blue and white skirt that wasn't like everybody else's. And my middle daughter said, oh, everything was with black printed. So I was at another event showing a friend of mine the skirt I was printing I was going to do for my next skirt. And the bourgeois came past and said, workshops? And I went, I don't think so. And at another event in February, we wanted two campsites instead of just one. And he said, in the spirit of rendezvous and fair trade, mm-hmm. you do some workshops, you have your sites.
And it's literally just grown from there. It was a complete mm-hmm. and total accident. We ended up becoming a millinery. We had actually just planned on camping. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to get invited along to an event when she was going. And my boys come out
too
now. So I
went to her renaissance. She went to the rendezvous and she wanted to dye her kids' shirts. Like everybody else's, found out that they were coffee and tea dyed muslin. And then began her dyeing, and I stay out of her dyeing.
And so total, she's got about 5 or 6 years in. This will be my second official year. It'll be our first year as a business actually working with the kids.
Oh, great.
We're still in the baby stages yet.
What is it that you like about it?
Well, like when you were over by the dye vats before and all the teachers were talking, and then we'll have even other rendezvousers. You can't get this kind of information even off the internet. We have people that have been doing this for 30, 40 years that will come over and not criticize, but give advice on how you can upgrade or change things, how you can get things closer to period correct. We know most of the camps out here. We know all the kids. It's such a big family group. I mean, you know when somebody's missing, and it's just, it's so much fun.
The other thing is the exchange of information.
Mm-hmm.
After the kids go home and the public goes home, mm-hmm. you visit. And it's kind of like each of you have a little piece of a puzzle, and as you visit and talk with each other, the puzzle just becomes literally an understanding of the past and the life. And it's fun too because I can't explain it. It's almost like in March you go, you've had enough by the end of the summer, enough campfire smoke, mm-hmm. but in February, March you find that box with your clothes in and go, camp smoke, ooh, rendezvous. Fire, you know, the lanterns, the tents, the stars.
For those of us that don't do it year round, you really do miss it by the time you hit March.
You can't explain, you can't film, you can't even describe what it's like to sit at night and see the Milky Way above you mm-hmm. with your cup of coffee by the fire and look down the row and see all the lanterns lit mm-hmm. and glowing and people sitting in their camps quietly visiting. And it's like you feel like you've literally gone back in time and are part of. And like I said, you can't, there's just no way to put it into words or pictures, or you just have to literally be part of it.
Beautiful. So thanks, ladies. Was that
well,
hard?
Hopefully
no.
That helps.
As long as you just get to talk and be myself, I'm fine. But literally, that's what I went through at Carol. We were at a High Plains rendezvous, and it was just sitting out there at the table at night with my big mug, and somebody came over and said, "You still messing with that fire? It's down to coals." It's like, no. And then he goes, "Do you really like this stuff?" It's like, look around you. We could hear laughter coming from the poker palace. It had been ladies' night, and all the bourgeois and the dog soldiers dressed up in saloon costumes and were giving the ladies shoulder rubs. You could hear this laughter coming across this whole wide open area with all these trees. People laughing and talking, and the stars and the Milky Way, and the coals were glowing and the lanterns. And he says, "Do you really like this?" And you just wanted to go.
Well, it's even what? Like working with the kids.
How
it's
can
hilarious.
You not?
They are so much fun, and they have so much information. Mm-hmm. We've had groups of homeschoolers that these little fifth and sixth graders have been able to blow our doors off with the information that they have, and it's so much fun to see them, even with the drawing and stuff, how really creative these kids are when you let them loose.
Well, and even our kids are lucky. Mm-hmm. My grandkids, her kids.
Very, very.
These kids are growing up like this. You know, they go home, they've got their video games. They've got the other things, but while they're out here, they don't miss them. They don't even think about them. They're learning how to tomahawk throw. Her oldest came home, the guy with one of the wood lathes, has him working on a wooden spoon. The knife stuff, the fire, the ability to build fire. He comes back and he's so excited, even like the guys walking past with the wood. If we had had 50 cents, we'd have gone ahead and gotten it. Her kids started out that way last year. Bringing firewood back and forth, and then a neighbor
this year
said
apprenticing with some of the different camps just
and
learning new stuff.
They said, and like we've explained, some of the kids go, "Oh, cool, you get out of school," and the kids are going, "Yeah, we do." And it's like You might want to explain the rest of it to them. But basically, they're allowed to go, but they've got to keep a journal. Mm-hmm. And when they get back, they have to do a presentation with pictures and stuff. Her now 8-year-old got to school, and it was funny.
They were going over a point in history where they were researching Ben Franklin and some of the inventions, and he hollers, "Well, I live right across the street from him. Franklin's my neighbor." The teacher calls me at the end of the school day going, "Do we need to rein in his imagination a little bit? I mean, do we need to talk about this?" And typical mom, I'm going, "No, we live right across from the Franklins at one of the events, and we talk to the Lincolns all the time. We go up and have tea."
Okay, and they're going, "Never mind about the kids, mother's."
What kind of medication do you need? So we took in pictures and stuff, and every year now, every event we go to, we basically take the week after and get things put together, and we go into the school, and he presents and puts up a little picture board and
they,
a little journal.
And they don't get out of their work either. They get back
and they have
and
their regular homework.
Work just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. But while they're out here, the kids go, "Cool, you got out of school." It's like, do you realize from the time those kids got up and had breakfast, they've been hauling how many loads of firewood, not only for us, but for other people in the camp. They've been hauling water.
They helped set up tents.
They hauled water for the Franklins, and Mrs. Franklin gave them a deck of cards with the Ben Franklin bills on the back of it. Tanner helped set up a wiki up, and the gentleman there works with the different stones and polished stones and stuff. And he taught Tanner how to polish them. He came home, he was just so excited to get something new. It isn't always money that they do. But they'll take their 50 cents.
Lot of it's trade.
But they'll take maybe their 50 cents or their dollar, and they'll go down and get rock candy. Well, while they're down there getting the rock candy, somebody's making rock candy. So they sit and they watch, and sometimes get to help add ingredients and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's they become part of, and like they say, it takes a village to raise a child. These kids come away every time with so much stuff that we've got a five-hour ride home.
Nonstop on the way back about who they met, what they did, what they got, what they're gonna show at school.
Oh wait, 5 hours away. Where are y'all from?
Greenfield, Iowa.
It's just a way of life. It's just something you understand why people go from camp to camp to camp and rendezvous to rendezvous.
There's a running giggle between a lot of the rendezvousers that were a little OCD, because once you start, it's very, very hard to stop. You want to improve camp, you want to improve your clothes, you want to improve what boxes you're bringing out, you want to fix the table so it looks more like this one, not this one, just to get it as close to period correct as you can.
It's just kind of a personal challenge. And who you meet and the information they have, it just all comes together. And it's kind of fun too if you ever sit back and watch. It starts out as nothing, just as a park. You've one tent, two tents, five tents, 10 tents, 20 tents, 140 tents, 2 days worth of city. All of a sudden the next day it goes 120 tents, you know, 99 tents, 80, 70, 60, down to one little lonely tent. And you're watching all these people with all these trucks pull out. And at the end of the season like this, you're going to see a lot of hugs, you're going to see a lot of tears.
Because a lot of us won't see each other for a good 6 months.
And then we turn around and start showing up at events again in the spring. And it's just like family seeing cousins, you know, that are far away.
Is this the last event of the year then?
For us.
Close.
For us. Okay. We don't win.
There are
yet.
A lot of them, of the ones that have a lot of experience that do the winter ones. Mm-hmm. They have some phenomenal survival style. True rendezvous, like in Montana and stuff, where the guys will literally have their deer hung from the tree and dinner. Yeah. I'm not up to that level
of
survival.
That's a little beyond our rustic level.
But those are the camps that you'll see. Those are some of the best camps. Mm-hmm. If you look at what they've got for equipment, their house style, where they put their fire, where they put their stoves, you can tell that they've had the experience with it. They haven't gone through making some of the mistakes a lot of us beginners are still making.
And it's a learning thing from camp to camp, too. You can always tell those of us that are beginners, because there's a couple with 2 years experience, a couple with 4 years experience, those of us that, we got one official one in, and you're going, "Oh, don't put your tent stakes in that way. It would be better if you tried this just so you stay standing." And it's never mean-spirited. It's all just to make sure the next one can keep going, too, because you want to bring more in.
Yeah, you want people, and like you said, it's kind of like family, but it's, to give you an idea, we've set this thing up like 10 different times. We usually have the boys hold the poles while we put the tent stakes in. It was a long ride. We told them, go play. So we did what we always do. We slid the poles in, pulled the awning up. She's got her tent stakes and her hammer in her hand. So we didn't forget any of those. We didn't forget the ropes. You know, they're over here and you can't leave. She's holding one. I'm holding the other.
Neither one of us can put the stakes or the ropes in because we both have a pole.
He walks past and he stops and very politely says, "Would you like some help?" He didn't ridicule. He didn't criticize. He just said, "Would you like some help?" As we're going, it's either that or we're standing here all night.
For a long time.
This way. Exactly.
But it's that way all over camp, too. If somebody pulls into camp in the evening and they're set up, or a couple of them came in during the rain the other night, you'll watch this entire, literally, herd of candles and people head down to help.
Yeah.
It's more of that small town feel you used to see a lot of.
Or if somebody comes in late night and has gotten set up and hasn't had time to eat and you've got extra chili or you've got, you know, something on, there's always more than
enough. Lots of community pots around
here. Or in the morning if somebody doesn't have a campfire going, they'll come by and ask if they can, you know, use the light from yours, light their campfire with your campfire. Or if you've got coffee on, they'll have a cup and just pour a cup of coffee. One day it may be them coming to our camp. One day we may go to camp that we're short on something. It is literally kind of a sharing and a family thing. It's kind of what they had to do back then, too. You had to be able to, if you were short on resources, you weren't going to make it. Somebody else had more than enough. They shared. Yeah. That is just kind of disappearing, and that's part of what all this is. Plus, like the, we've been at a few that have camp meetings, and at the camp meetings, the Pledge of Allegiance is said.
The full and abridged version.
And in general, you know, the weapons, the kids.
Even my boys, they both have neck knives, being 10 and 8, and they both understand if they're out when they're not supposed to be, they're gone. They know how to handle them. They handle the tomahawks, and they're starting to learn how to do the muzzle loaders. And I'd much rather have them learning the right way than having, you know, some school buddy of theirs dig in, you know, dad's cabinet and pull out something and have to deal with the consequences of that one. These guys know what to do now and when to use them and when not. But it's kind of like the rendezvousers, too. Most of us are all in the same boat. We all have our heavy-duty day jobs and stuff. We come out here to relax. This is fun. You get to put all the computers and everything else away for just a few hours and just relax.
Well, and the kids with the education part of it, too, when you're talking the knives and the other things, the guys that have the hawk blocks are good at the hawk blocks. Are the ones that are showing them the right way to do stuff. It's not like they're just going up and throwing them for the heck of it. There's an adult around. And if there's not an adult around to supervise, somebody else at camp sees them. They send them home. It's not an environment that you have to be afraid of. In other words, if Tanner is down doing something Tanner's not supposed to do, whoever's there is going to say, hey, enough. So we can relax, too, that he's not going to get by with something he shouldn't be doing.
Or is in this society right now, let's say you're in a store and you see the kids just completely losing it.
All right.
And the mother's not there. I mean,
most people walk off.
Or you would be told, why are you talking my kid that way?
Yep. Like nope. Around here, we had a whole group. There's a total of about 15 kids that are all friends from different groups just in this small area here that were all over playing hide and go seek and what was it, Ghost in the Graveyard and Marco Polo the other night. And all of us folks were all in our camps. It's not like any of us were standing right there. And they played for a good 4 hours up until about 9 o'clock at night just having fun. They got to go be kids instead of being in the little cage at home because you can't go outside. You can't go, you know, to the park
and
alone
anymore.
And it
wasn't like they had to have an adult right on top of them. That's, I think, some of it, too. As adults, you get to relax. You don't rely on the people next to you to raise your kids by any means, but you've got the security. Okay, like our boys aren't here right this second. We know that whatever adults they're with around here are kind of keeping an eye on them, but yet at the same time, they've got the freedom to make mistakes, too. It's not like they constantly have to have an adult saying, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this.
There's quite a few times they've come home muddy, or earlier when we first were moving into camp, my youngest came back complaining because he managed to drop himself in the river up to about his knees, and he got to figure out how to air dry, and it's nothing that's going to hurt him. It's nothing that's bad. It's all life lessons, and he's discovered now not to go down by the river when mom says to leave it alone.
and making choices. You know, the difference that they actually get to make choices. They're not made for them, and they're expecting them to live by them. They make those choices.
It's one of those, like she said, too, it's an environment you can't put into a picture. You can't explain. I mean, you really have to be out here to get the gist of the whole thing. You really do. And the nice thing is to have a group this large where you're looking at a couple hundred tents out here and stuff and have most of the adults in the same mindset. It's really cool to have that many people in the same area. And there aren't major issues. I mean, yeah, you get people that, you know, may not get along all the time, but it's not the vicious, nasty political stuff you get in the everyday.
Everybody kind of, even when you look now, people are going from camp to camp. They're just visiting,
you're
saying
checking
hi.
Checking in with your neighbors.
And sometimes it's people you don't even know that become friends.
Yeah.
You just...
Plus, it's almost dinner time. We all wander camp and look to see what's going on.
No, you guys didn't spend the night here, you guys.
No, we camp out while we're out here.
We have been here since...
Monday.
Yeah, yeah. We left home Monday morning, and we were here about 2:30 in the afternoon. We've been here since.
There were a lot that were here very early.
We didn't have a choice because we both had to work on the weekend. But we left on Monday morning, got out here, and then we've had kids Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And we got one more coming up on Friday.
Another day.
So we'll be here until the end, and then as everybody tears down Sunday night, like I said, it just sort of, it's kind of like that village that rises up out of the sand and then sinks back down in the sand.
It literally does, one tent at a time. It's just, it's phenomenal to watch.
Well, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. I mean, we really appreciate it.
Thank you for taking the time with us.
A big thank you to Jean Hoffman and Andrea Ellis from Faribault Millinery for sharing with us their rendezvous experiences. Another thank you goes out to all participants of the Big Muddy River Rendezvous, especially Luca Cord and Alex Knox, for allowing us to come and record the events of the Big Muddy River Rendezvous. Watch for it next year in Winona.
Thanks for listening to Don't You Know? Support for this program is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Don't You Know is produced by KQAL-FM to keep you up to date on the people, places, and events in and around Winona. Visit us online at kqal.org.